Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 445, Side A. The program is titled The Bush Family and the Intelligence Community, and this is being recorded on February 8th of the year 2004. Before we begin, let me remind you that WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DAVEEMORY. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. Also, within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 445 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. For listeners that want to pursue some of this material and have some hard copy, that's the place to go. Also, listeners have asked how they can support the work that I'm doing. At the beginning of each description on the For the Record in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there is a page that they can visit in order to gain instructions on same. Now, this program is going to feature to a considerable extent a very important new book. It's been getting a fair amount of media play, but I think veteran listeners to this program will find it very satisfying in a profound way, perhaps more so than the general public. The book is called American Dynasty, subtitled Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. This book is important not only because what it says and the documentation provided, but also the author himself. Kevin Phillips is not only a mainstream author, but is a real conservative, not a fascist, as many conservatives are, but is a true conservative and not a cynical opportunist. And he is indeed a mainstream political figure. And for that reason, this book, again, American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush, is very, very important indeed. I think veteran listeners to this program will find the material in this book to be not only enlightening, but will also, I think, find it quite satisfying to read because of the degree of corroboration that it provides to many of the things that I have been pointing out over the years. There are a few places where the things that I talk about are not discussed past a point, or perhaps even a punch or two lightly pulled, but then Kevin Phillips is in a different situation than I am. He is mainstream media and must necessarily avoid the cachet of being labeled a conspiracy theorist. You know, he's not going to want to be known as another Dave Emery, certainly. But nonetheless, this is a book that I can't recommend too highly. And for people that have endured the slings and arrows of discourtesy at the hands of those they've tried to turn on to this kind of information, I think this book will be a vindication of a very profound sort. One of the things that occasioned my decision to use this particular book was the composition of a commission that was assembled by George Bush to look into the U.S. intelligence failures with regard to the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. An article about that appeared in The Guardian, a British paper, of February 6, 2004. The article is titled Bush Announces WMD Commission. It's by George Wright, and it reads in part as follows. George Bush, the U.S. president, today announced the formation of a commission to investigate failures in intelligence used to justify the war in Iraq. Mr. Bush said, "We are determined to find out what happened," unquote. In a televised briefing at 6:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, Mr. Bush said the 9-member panel, to be chaired by a former governor of Virginia, Charles Robb, and a retired judge, Lawrence Silberman, would be instructed to report on its findings in March of 2005. Lawrence Silberman is a very interesting figure, and one of the major chapters in Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty is called The Wars of the Texas Succession. It deals with both Persian Gulf Wars. It deals with the Iran-Contra and Iraq-Gate affair. It deals with the October surprise, the apparent collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 and the Khomeini forces in Iran, which resulted in the sabotaging of the 1980 election. And indeed, one of the things that Kevin Phillips points out is that the profound connections of the Bush family to the national security establishment, to mainstream American industry and finance, and in particular to the intelligence community, these being connections that have obtained over a period of decades, put the elder George Bush and his successors in a position to pivotally arrange national security, clandestine operations, the shipments of arms, and ultimately to play a significant part in the prosecution or even the precipitation of major wars. And those wars, the two Persian Gulf Wars and others, are labeled by Kevin Phillips the Wars of the Texas Succession. He also, by the way, talks about Lyndon Johnson, his connections to the petroleum industry and what took place during the Vietnam War. And that's interesting in and of itself. But one of the things one discovers with regard to the Bush family, and indeed when one looks at the current Bush administration, it's apparent that this is a line of succession. In For the Record programs 248 and 249, both recorded during the fall of 2000 upon the occasion of the 2000 presidential campaign being fully launched, I noted that from what we could tell about the younger George Bush, his administration in all probability would take its cues from his father's administration and in turn from the two Reagan administrations, because the key people in the younger Bush's campaign and on the ticket were people who played a significant role in the various machinations that the elder George Bush engaged in when he was president and when he was vice president behind Ronald Reagan. Indeed, I think listeners can go to the download-only WFMU website. Download For the Record program 248. It's not on the streaming website, but download FTR 248. Look at the description of that in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and then read American Dynasty. I think you'll find it to be a very enlightening experience. Now, with regard to George Bush's selection of the people to man this particular commission. By the way, former Virginia Governor Robb is, I believe, a son-in-law of Lyndon Baines Johnson. I will double-check that, but I believe that's the case. But certainly Lawrence Silberman is a very, very interesting figure indeed, and he is not only a Reagan judicial appointee, but someone who has played a significant role in some of the clandestine and dirty politics that have obtained in the United States since 1980. Indeed, I think Lawrence Silberman could be seen as one of a member of a cast of characters that have figured in what Kevin Phillips terms the Wars of the Texas Succession. The next article comes from the Consortium News website. The full URL will be listed in the description for the record. This is called Last Word, Judge Walsh's Warning, and this concerns Judge Lawrence Walsh, who was investigating the Iran-Contra affair and had his investigation and his indictments overturned by the elder George Bush just before he left office. One of the things we're going to see here is that Lawrence Silberman, again, a Reagan judicial appointee, played a significant role in overturning the conviction of Oliver North. Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh was a widely respected Republican of the old school. He had helped Thomas Dewey break Tammany Hall's corrupt grip on New York City, but Walsh was also admired by Richard Nixon, who wanted Walsh to be the original Watergate Special Prosecutor, according to H.R. Haldeman's diaries. So when the Iran-Contra scandal broke wide open in the fall of 1986, a senior three-judge federal panel tapped Walsh, known for his distinguished Republican legal career, to be the special prosecutor in charge of the complex investigation into President Reagan's foreign policy misadventures. For the next 6 years, Walsh oversaw a serious, though plodding, probe of the scandal, infuriating Republican leaders such as Bob Dole, who favored a tidy cover-up. Walsh's diligence also led to a behind-the-scenes power play by conservative federal judges to undercut Walsh's probe and turn the special prosecutor apparatus into another tool of conservative power. This legal coup began when hardline Reagan judges David Sentell and Lawrence Silberman overturned Walsh's felony conviction of Oliver North by a 2-1 vote. Sentell, a protege of North Carolina's conservative Senator Jesse Helms, was also part of the panel that reversed the guilty verdicts against North's White House boss Admiral John Poindexter. By the way, Poindexter was appointed by George Bush to a sensitive Pentagon intelligence function as well. Continuing, when Walsh moved to appeal the North ruling, which was based on unprecedented application of immunity rules, Walsh was supported by the Justice Department's Career Appellate Division, but Walsh was opposed by Bush's Solicitor General, none other than Kenneth Starr. While the battle over the North case played out, conservative Chief Justice William Rehnquist was fixing the game at another level. He replaced the senior panel that traditionally picked special prosecutors with a new panel run by Sentell. The revamped panel was in place when Republican Robert Fisk was ousted as Whitewater special prosecutor and was replaced by a legal conservative activist, Starr. So again, note the position of this three-judge panel, including Lawrence Silberman. They not only overturned the convictions of Oliver North and Admiral John Poindexter, but they played a key role in helping to boost Bush's former Solicitor General, Kenneth Starr, into the position of Clinton Inquisitor. And by the way, something like, so Whitewater got underway by the mid-90s. 6 or 7 years of investigation, $74 million in tax and federal in public tax monies produced nothing. It was one of the bigger and more loudly trumpeted zeros in recent history. But it certainly did help to destroy Bill Clinton, and ultimately it led to the Monica Lewinsky affair, probably the most costly BJ in political history. But again, note the position of Lawrence Silberman in this particular situation, and note the political inertia that characterizes this administration and that signals its continuity from administrations past. We're next going to excerpt some material from the Congressional Record. This was placed into the Congressional Record by Gary Sick, a Carter administration official who had been involved with the Carter administration's attempts to get the hostages out of Tehran. And Gary Sick is one of a number of authors who have come forward on behalf of what has been termed the October Surprise, the apparent collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the U.S. Embassy in 1979 until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. There have been a number of differences between various October Surprise writers on various points of information, but the overall vector that, in fact, there was collusion, decisive collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces is at this point beyond intelligent debate, although there are certainly those who will continue to ignore it. But note again what, at least according to Gary Sick, was the alleged involvement of Lawrence Silberman in some of the shenanigans between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces, and this basically in any other society would be termed treason. From Gary Sick's allegations as entered into the Congressional Record, and again, a full URL will be available in the description for the show. In September of 1980, Allen, that's Richard Allen, a former Nixon aide who was the first national security advisor for Ronald Reagan. In September 1980, Allen got a call from Robert McFarlane, then an authority on Iran for the Senate Armed Services Committee. McFarlane told Allen that he knew a representative of the Iranian government who might be useful. Quote, McFarlane wanted us to meet him. He was emphatic, recalls Allen. And against my better judgment, I agreed. Allen asked another campaign advisor, Lawrence Silberman, to accompany him. The four met in the lobby of L'Enfant Plaza Hotel in Washington. The Iranian envoy informed them that he was on good terms with Khomeini's inner circle. Quote, then he spun a web about how he could get the hostages released directly to our campaign before the election, recalls Silberman. And at that point, we cut him off. Neither Allen nor I had any interest in his proposal. I told him flat out that we have only one president at a time and that all deals regarding the hostages would have to go through official channels, unquote. After 20 minutes, Allen and Silberman thanked the Iranian envoy for his concern and left. End of story. If you take them at their word, everyone behaved with what Silberman called scrupulous propriety. Maybe. In the interest of national security, the Reagan team certainly could have reported this overture to the White House, as the Anderson campaign had honorably done with Hushang Lavi. I would note that one of the things that emerged during Debategate was the fact that the Reagan-Bush campaign had top-secret documents that had been taken by the Iranian kidnappers from the U.S. embassy when it had been seized. So this raises the obvious question as to how documents taken from the U.S. embassy by the Iranian kidnappers could have wound up in the hands of the Reagan-Bush campaign for the debates between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan in the 1980 campaign. You don't have to be Lieutenant Columbo or Sherlock Holmes to figure that out, but unfortunately that has managed to elude the vision of an awful lot of American journalists. However, the October surprise shenanigans, the collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran, is among the many things that is discussed in the book American Dynasty by Kevin Phillips. This book is just out. It's published by Viking and is copyright, I would assume, 2003. And 2004, actually, by Kevin Phillips. And there is a great deal of material in this book that will be familiar to veteran listeners to this program. Kevin Phillips puts a somewhat different spin on some of it than I would. He certainly doesn't go into the Borman and Underground Reich connections because that, you know, in all fairness, would get him labeled a kook. There is, however, extensive accessing of sources like John Loftus, Christopher Simpson, and others. And one of the things that Kevin Phillips goes into at great length, again, one will see some differences between my presentation of the material and Kevin Phillips, which is fine, but one of the things that Kevin Phillips goes into is the deep involvement of the Bush clan and their in-laws, the Walkers, with Wall Street businesses that did business with Adolf Hitler to an enormous extent. There's a considerable discussion of the Union Banking Corporation, Hamburg America Line, the Silesian American Corporation, and also the Remington Company and Bush family members that were involved with Remington, and the shipping of U.S. arms to German forces in the early 1930s as Hitler was preparing to seize power. I'm not going to go into the details concerning the Bush-Walker clan's dealings with Nazi Germany past a point here, but it is dealt with extensively in the book. And one of the points that Kevin Phillips makes is that for decades, the Bush family was heavily involved with the munitions makers of this country and with what has come to be called the National Security Establishment, and that it is in part their relationship with the National Security Establishment and other elements in the American corridors of power that has permitted the founding and the perpetuation of this American dynasty. But again, veteran listeners of this program will recognize a lot of material and in this book. Just consider the following in the context of, among other broadcasts, FTR 441. This concerns the recycling of the tremendous amount of capital that was made in the United States during World War I and the 1920s and its investment in Germany. Reading from Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty. In the 1920s, Germany had been by far the most important international market for recycling the new private U.S. capital created by the war. Most of this U.S. investment, which approached $2 billion, took the form of loans to German industry, direct investment in German companies, loans to German municipalities, and endless dollars of Dawes plan credits. Christopher Simpson, in The Splendid Blonde Beast, listed the principal U.S. firms that bought or began establishing major German subsidiaries or joint ventures during the 1920s. AT&T, General Motors, Ford, Standard Oil of New Jersey, and General Electric. All were among America's dozen largest companies. U.S. overseas investment didn't end with Hitler's accession to power. Capital continued to move to Germany during the 1930s under the Third Reich. Reports by the U.S. Commerce Department showed the U.S. investment in Germany increased by 48.5% between 1929 and 1940, while declining almost everywhere else in continental Europe. By 1939, many of these various units, manufacturing engines, armored chassis, and artificial rubber, were mainstays of the German war machine. As pricey, immobile assets that could not be repatriated, The large German subsidiaries were also important props of the valuations of many of the biggest U.S. companies. Instead of the obvious pro-Allied economic self-interest of 1917, many major corporations faced a very different conundrum in 1939 through 41. Top executives and investment bankers, uncertain about what they ought to do or how they ought to take cover, hired lawyers like John Foster and Alan Dulles. By the way, they are of Sullivan and Cromwell, and we've talked about Sullivan and Cromwell and the Dulleses through the ages as well. They not only helped to mask the Bush family's assets invested on behalf of Nazi Germany, but Alan Dulles helped to found Saudi Arabia, and Sullivan and Cromwell is the chief counsel for Saudi Bin Laden Group to this day. One of the things that the author Kevin Phillips writes about, and that is the transition after World War II, when many of the people within this American-German transatlantic industrial and financial axis went to work along with the newly allied Germans against the former Soviet Union. By the way, before we go into this, bear in mind, too, that the same pattern of investment, Wall Street investment, took place in Japan. Prior to World War II. That was one of the things that enabled the Japanese to surge all over Asia, and that the same sort of cover-up and retrenchment of the old order in Japan took place after World War II as well. And I think in the embodiment of this administration, the prominence of the Moon Organization, discussed in FTR number 7 and 11, and also in, for the record, 84 and 291 as the perpetuation of the Japanese Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies. The Moon Organization has been heavily involved with the elder George Bush and plays a prominent role with the younger George Bush as well. And so I think the Japanese Wall Street connection and the perpetuation of underground Japanese fascist interests can also be seen as being embodied with this administration. Turning now to the post-World War II retrenchment that these elements engaged in, and turning to Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty, the speed with which post-war U.S. military and intelligence officers welcomed anti-Soviet Germans who had worn Hitler's insignia throughout the war reflected the historical preference for practicality over morality. Considerable portions of the German Abwehr and wartime Reinhard Gehlen organization, Fremde Heere Ost, the army intelligence group monitoring Eastern Europe and Russia, had shifted to the employ of the United States by 1950, implementing the anti-Soviet alliance scores of Germans had discussed with Stuart Menzies of British Intelligence and Alan Dulles in other days and other uniforms. Hans Gasevius, the agent sent by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris and German intelligence to meet with Alan Dulles in wartime Switzerland, was about to begin a new Cold War role, carrying messages and ideas from Neil Mallon at Dresser Industries to the same Alan Dulles, soon to head the CIA. By the way, Dresser Industries was George Bush's, the elder George Bush's, first employer when he in the post-World War II period. And Dresser Industries is now part of Halliburton, of course. The former CEO of Halliburton is Dick Cheney. Continuing. In 1950, Robert A. Levette himself was Deputy Secretary of Defense and about to become Secretary. Averell Harriman was the president's national security advisor. Prescott Bush was about to run for the U.S. Senate from Connecticut. Alan Dulles was deputy director of the CIA. And John Foster Dulles was waiting for the next Republican president to appoint him to the post of Secretary of State, earlier held by his grandfather and his uncle. Whatever these men and their investment banks and law firms had or hadn't done for I.G. Farben, Fritz Thyssen, and the Union Banking Corporation, in terms of broad politics, at least, they had picked the right side, the camp that became the U.S. national security establishment. Then, skipping down, Kevin Phillips writes about the relationship between Alan Dulles and Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of the current seated president, and one of the people who was involved with Union Banking Corporation and some of their post-war shenanigans with the Nazi Flight Capital Program. That is not discussed by Kevin Phillips. It's one of the few omissions in the book. But one of the points that Kevin Phillips makes is that the connections, the industrial and political connections of the Bush family, led to a very prominent intelligence role by Prescott Bush Sr. Bush also kept up with the Dulles brothers. In 1946, Almost as soon as Allen Dulles was back in New York, Bush had him to lunch. In 1961, when Dulles was pushed from his CIA director's area because of the Bay of Pigs foul-up, he made it a point on the day before his successor, John McCone, was named, to bring McCone along to a dinner with Prescott Bush. In 1962, as Bush was about to leave the Senate, he helped to launch the new National Strategy Information Center to be run by Frank Barnett, a right-tilting expert on political warfare and covert operations who had previously directed research at North Carolina's CIA-linked Smith-Richardson Foundation. Bush knew well those involved because during the early 1950s, at the request of H. Smith Richardson and his son-in-law, Eugene Stetson, a bonesman and former Brown Brothers Harriman colleague of Bush's, he had given the Richardsons advice and supportive counsel on setting up their foundation. Which brings us to what in the television quiz show parlance of that very era was called the $64,000 question. Who and what was Prescott Bush in the U.S. intelligence community? And did he leave a legacy to his son? The senior Bush was not of the intelligence community, but in the sense of having been director or an official of the OSS or CIA. But he was indisputably close to it, probably as a confidant, asset, or high-level counselor, much as Juan Trippa of Pan American Airways and William S. Paley of CBS were widely thought to have been. Indeed, Prescott Bush was a long-serving member of both Trippa's and Paley's corporate boards. He was also a wartime member of two companies, the Vanadium Corporation of America and Dresser Industries, that provided uranium ore and uranium gaseous diffusion pumps, respectively, for the Manhattan Project and subsequent atomic bomb development. By the way, the reference there to Bonesman refers to the Skull and Bones group at Yale, one of the Yale secret societies. Inside two of this program, we're going to examine just how many of the key players in the various branches of the Bush family were part of Skull and Bones, and also the role that Skull and Bones apparently played in the development of the U.S. intelligence community. It would be difficult to exaggerate the influence of Skull and Bones, but we'll be getting into that more inside two of this broadcast. The various programs that I've been doing over the years are stocked by a CD duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. You can reach them by email at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL, linked to both a wfmu.org/Dave Emery URL and also to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Now, on the Spitfire website, the most recently recorded pair of half-hour segments are available for a week or so for download only on Real Audio. And in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program 445 within a week or so of the airing of this program. At the beginning of each description of each For the Record program, there is a notation that people can click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 445, The Bush Family and the Intelligence Community, being recorded on February 8th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.